Welcome to the Flow Tracy Bunny Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:36 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is February 17th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with German Bunds. For a brief period this week, they surmounted the 2.5% level and eased back a bit in here today, but it's been a pretty profound move in terms of yield over the course of the last 2 years. Back in the teeth of the pandemic panic in March of 2020, the yield on the 10-year bund got to negative 92 basis points, and today was really a lot closer to 2.5%. So the reality here is that we've had about 350 basis points of a rise, or close on anyway, or 340 basis points of a rise in the space of a little bit more than 3 years, or not quite 3 years. That's an enormous move. And when we just look at the total number of bonds that were trading with a negative yield, well, it peaked right at the end of 2020. And it got up to as high as 17 and three quarter trillion. And at the end of last year, it was almost zero. So we've had a move in bonds that's profound in by any stretch of the imagination, because investors who were holding negative yielding debt at the end of 2020 have lost really significant volumes of cash. And despite that, there's still a large volume of cash floating around. But the big point, of course, is that for a creditor nation like Germany, the move out of negative yielding debt, where they enjoyed the privilege of having investors pay them to take their money for about 18 months, well, that isn't going to be the end of the world if they have to then turn around and start paying 2.5% for that money. But then let's think about corporates, because it wasn't simply that governments had negative yielding debt, but lots of corporations were enjoying that privilege as well, and most particularly European corporates. So I did have a look at Robert Bosch in here today. And I thought that was an interesting chart to look at, because this was a or this is a company which has enjoyed negative yielding debt for really quite some time. And then, as soon as we got to the beginning of 2020, it popped back above zero, and now we're at a yield well in excess of 3%. Now, there are, of course, very particular characteristics here. The first is that this is an automotive supplier, and if more companies are building electric vehicles, they don't need quite as many supplies. So not only do you have rising interest rates, but you have the prospect of less demand for products. Now, of course, every car is still going to need a steering wheel, at least for the moment. And they're going to need mirrors, and they're going to need all sorts of bits and pieces to go into the car. But they're not going to need engines, and that is a really big change for the automotive sector. So there's the real prospect that it's going to hit smaller companies, less those that are listed. And the ones that have been held private for a long time, like Robert Bosch, are probably going to experience quite a bit of pain. But then let's just think about this, because I thought this was a really interesting chart that I saw this week. And it helps to highlight that there's 6.3 trillion that of bonds that need to mature. And this is excluding governments, banks, and insurers. So within the corporate bond universe, there's at least an average of 200 billion that is going to mature every single month between now and the end of 2025. So when we start to think about where the issues are going to arise, well, some companies are going to be fine. They're going to see that they have pricing power. They've been able to pass along rising costs, the rising cost of servicing debt in particular, and that they will weather this storm no problem. But then there are also going to be those that were heavily levered heading into this issue and into the end of 2020 were borrowing more money or had engaged in paying very high prices during M&A activity. So they're going to find that refinancing is really difficult. And there's a ton. In fact, the highest month for refinancing is going to be in March. So there's obviously then pressure on the corporate sector that is going, I think, largely unreported when we think about the size of the move off the lows we had at the beginning of this year. Then we're not quite yet there in terms of the potential. Now, I know for a fact that and there's a lot of people, and particularly people who want to be very bullish, are going to say, well, every bear market is going to bottom in a climax of negativity. And every bear market ends when interest rates are coming down. But the reality is that interest rates are not coming down. And until they do start coming down, and then that's usually when you see some of the greatest pressure on the stock market. It's after they've come down and been down for a while that you see the bottom. Doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to correspond with the end of the cutting cycle. The end of the cutting cycle doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to coincide with the bottom in the stock market. You would anticipate that stocks would bottom before the end of the cutting cycle, but it doesn't mean that stocks will bottom before they even begin to start cutting. So we're, I think, still in a rather tense environment in terms of stock markets. And this is most particularly true then of the NASDAQ. So the NASDAQ index is hovering here around the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, I think it's important when we think about the long term to look at the log scale chart because a lot of investors aren't going to be paying attention to how much the market moves on a daily basis. And they're not going to be as concerned with the outlook for the price movements. What they will be looking at is percentage movements. And I think that's why the log scale chart is very important when we address the secular trend. So there have been several occasions when the NASDAQ pulled back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And on each of those occasions, it bounced. And it did it again this time. So, from the perspective of a long-term investor, I can understand that there would certainly be a willingness to buy in the region of the 1,000-day moving average because that has historically offered clear evidence of support starting to come back in. So, then of course, it does beg the question, are we still in a secular bull market for the technology sector? And I think then we should be paying attention to the fact that a log scale chart, it tends to shrink accelerations. So let's just remind ourselves that what is it that propels a big bull market? Well, you need a story. You need a big, inspiring story to really get people to invest. And the big inspiring story that got everybody animated about technology and the performance of the NASDAQ from about 2012 onwards was 4G. So not only did you have the Apple iPhone that came out in 2008, but then you also had the rollout of 4G networks. So you had rapid app creation and mobile access to the internet, and that birthed a whole new brand of company. So then we saw that lots more of social activities moved online, retail moved online, or moved even further online. Then we had the birth of cloud computing, which was, I think, when I was writing Crowd Money back in 2012, it was completely misunderstood and not really well understood at all. And since then, the cloud sector has done enormously well. And then we had the continued rise of the global consumer. Then we had oil prices in a secular bear market because there was a massive source of new supply had been unleashed, and the USA went from being the biggest importer to being a net exporter in the space of only 7 or 8 years. So there were lots of interesting things to be bullish about. And then, of course, there was lots of progress had been made on artificial intelligence. And then we had the big promises. So we had promises about the promise of autonomous vehicles, the promise of personalized medicine. And then we had some things delivered, like reusable rockets. So there are certain, and I think that that is a trend that has not been fully explored by the markets yet, because there is a dearth of companies that one can invest in. But it's also very hard to, I think, diverge the outlook for commercial space flight with geopolitical concerns and the defense sector. But so we definitely had, I think, just to get back to the point, we definitely had a big bull market because it was propelled by really attractive ideas. But the other thing that you need for a big bull market is additional new money. And there was lots of money printed. And as recently as 2019, there were very clear fears about prolonged deflation. And there were magazine articles where it showed that inflation had been killed off. It was like the dead dinosaur. And then what we've had since then is a big return of inflationary pressures. Let's just think about that money supply, because in the aftermath of the credit crisis, where we had this phenomenally large decline, there was a panicky environment, and everyone was worried about a second shoe dropping. Central banks then cut interest rates to the bone, flooded the global markets with liquidity, and then bond yields stayed low for a long time. And there were real fears that we were never going to have inflation again. So what that also did was it pushed money into the kinds of assets that have got long durations. Now, I think that it's also worth just reminding ourselves, what is a long duration asset? So everybody tends to think of a long duration asset from a stock market perspective. And that would be the kind of company that doesn't have earnings now. But if it reaches its potential, it will have outsized earnings in future. And one of the favorite ones, particularly from ARK Innovation, Innovations ETF, was Roku. So they started buying the share back in 2018, and then it just went haywire in 2020. Now, it's the type of company that does not have a big market, but has a lot of promise to have a big market. And it's basically a box that sits on top of your TV, and you can get extra channels with it without having to pay for a cable subscription. So it's like cable TV over the internet. And lots of people bought it, and then they make money by selling advertising. That's why their share went up this week, because they said that their advertising revenue improved. But I think it's a very good example of a long duration asset. But these types of companies that don't have strong earnings, and let's just pay attention to the fact that It used to have a PE, now it doesn't. So when you're talking about companies that don't have earnings, well, when they don't have any earnings, then their duration and the expectation for when those earnings will appear is way, way out there in the future. But then there are much more concrete examples of what a long duration asset means. So I was at this, I was invited to this dinner about 2 months ago, and it really left just a lasting impression upon me that you had a hedge fund direct mailing people that live in more affluent neighborhoods, and then inviting them to a free steak dinner in order to capture their time so they could try and sell them a hedge fund product. And then what I found particularly interesting is not so much the efficacy of the hedge fund strategy, but instead the fact that they had completely outsourced the hedge book to Goldman Sachs. So Goldman Asset Management now runs the hedge exposure for a very significant proportion of the hedge funds in the USA. And what they have in that hedge are very long duration assets. And by that, what I mean is not so much that when you're investing in a business or a building, that there aren't cash flows coming off of it, but that you can't get your money back, that you might have a lock-in of a decade. And when interest rates are low, when inflation is not problematic, and when the economy is expanding, locking money up for a decade is a reasonable argument. When you have more volatility, higher interest rates, and the threat of recession, locking money up for a decade is problematic. But it's really much more problematic when you start to see that borrowers are defaulting on buildings that they've leased. And this is starting to happen. So, Brookfield defaulted on two towers in Los Angeles this week, and the share is pulling back from the region of the 200-day moving average. Then we have Blackstone, where they've stopped redemptions from several of their institutional real estate funds. Then you have Simon Property Group is walking away from a mall that they had been responsible for paying interest on in New Jersey. So we should be thinking then about not simply that these individual companies are starting to walk away from their debt, and thinking more about this trend we've seen, where there has been just a procession of institutional money managers, people managing pension funds, just beating a path to the door of these companies, offering them money to invest in these long duration assets because they had a necessity. So we know what happened with UK pensions over the course of Q3 and Q4 in the UK. And the 10-year yield went from 1.75% to 4.5%. Or I guess, is that, I should say, is that 5%, 4.5%, in the space of only about 3 months. Now, the reason for that is UK pensions got around the problem of the prevailing bond yield being too low to meet their obligation needs by taking on leverage. So when inflation did pick up and when interest rates were rising, then that caused a what we might just refer to as a traditional margin call. Now, it was an exceptionally large margin call, but that is what it was. And subsequently, the Bank of England had to re-engage, pour money into the system, brought the yield back down in a swift manner, and it's been hovering here above 3%, and the Bank of England is still raising rates. So they were able to contain the contagion risk by flooding the market with liquidity, and subsequently then went on to continue to raise rates. Now you have a very different problem in North America, particularly in the USA. A lot of the pension funds, particularly public pensions and those that are managed by unions, whether and that is not just public but also private pensions that are managed by unions, are populated by people with no experience of working in the financial industry, and they're essentially union reps. So when you have talented salespeople who come in and offer them a solution to the problem of not having enough yield to meet their long-term obligations, telling them that they're so smart for investing in something that has a long duration and that it matches up perfectly with the needs of a long-term fiduciary like a pension. So they've been gobbling up these structures. And we also saw that the California Teachers Union poured an extra $4 billion into Blackstone's institutional real estate fund before Christmas or just after Christmas. So that's also important to highlight that when these funds start to go bad, then the it's almost like a Sophie's choice for the investors. They're going to be presented with basically what is an ultimatum. And they're going to be told, well, the yields on these things are going to disappear because we don't have any tenants. And the companies that we invested in, well, they're defaulting on the ownership of these things. So we might be losing the asset as well. But if you give us some extra money, well, then we might be able to sustain this business for a while longer, and you will still get some of your cash flows back. And of course, then the pension isn't in much of a position to argue. So it's basically lose all of your investment now, or lose some of your investment, and then put some more in, and you might be able to rescue it. Then that's basically what they're doing. So when we start to think then about what are the animating factors behind a big secular bull market, well, we know that long duration assets and the money that was flowing into them was one of the animating factors behind all of the performance that we saw on the technology sector in small companies, in large companies, and most then, of course, obviously focused on the eight mega cap companies that profited most from those bullish characteristics and those big bull stories. Well, right now we have an inverted yield curve, and we did not have an inverted yield curve between 2008 and 2020. So this is something to pay attention to, that monetary conditions are tightening. So when we think about the two big factors you need for a secular bull market, well, the first one is a story and the second one is money. Well, you still have plenty of stories. So we have the artificial intelligence story and this rapid commercialization story that OpenAI has now got a system that is really good at conversational English. And there's a big question then about how quickly can it be used to do really useful stuff, and what's the error rate, and there's all of the if but questions, but there's no longer a question about whether it exists or not. So this is obviously something that a lot of people are very excited about. And we've seen a really solid rebound in related shares. But then it's also hit companies like Google. So Google has pulled back from the region of the 200-day moving average. And there are politicians lining up for antitrust. And their 100 plus billion ad business is being assailed from all sides. On the one hand, you have antitrust politicians, but then on the other, you have AI looking to capture some market share. So I think it is more likely than not that the peak is around $150 and that we're going to have a good deal of ranging while these questions are answered. So this is what we kind of get when the money fountain isn't as prolific as it was in the past. And then when we think about the fact that money supply growth is now negative, and it's negative for the first time in history. So we know that they plowed money into the market in 2020, and then they slowly started taking it out in 2021, and the pace of that accelerated in 22, and now they're actively taking money out of the market. So the size of the Fed's balance sheet is contracting. So one thing that we know is whenever they do this, and we're not there yet, obviously, because the Purchasing Managers Index, or the PPI, was higher in here this week. But when they've reduced the size of their balance sheet, it has coincided with deflationary forces. This was the case in 2018 and 19. We are not quite there yet, but the fact is that the size of the Fed's balance sheet is contracting. It means that they are reducing liquidity. When we look back at what happened in Europe in 2012 through 14, they reduced the size of the balance sheet by $1 trillion, and there was a real fear of deflation. Well, they've done exactly the same thing over the course of the last 6 months. So they've taken money out of the system way faster than they did in 2012 and 13. And I think this is this is one of the more important points. There's a lagged effect between when yields go up and the impact is felt in the economy. And there is a lagged effect between when they reduce the size of the balance sheet and when deflationary forces show up. And there is a lagged effect when you have an inverted yield curve and when the negative effects of that show up in the stock market. And we have all of these lead indicators for a deflationary shock at really sounding the alarm. And we still have people talking about the possibility that there will be no landing at all and that a recession will be completely avoided. Now, I remember when I used to believe in Santa Claus. I also remember when I found out that Santa Claus wasn't real, and that was when I was in my grandmother's house, and she lived in a 200-year-old home. And there was always a fire burning in the hearth, and it was a sense of there was always a sense of warmth and mystery there because you could always poke around. But I found an antique set of, it wasn't Lego, but it was building blocks under her bed, and it was in December, and I didn't know whether it was for me or I should be looking at those things, so I kept my mouth shut. And then I found them under the Christmas tree 2 or 3 weeks later, and I felt absolutely triumphant. And I kind of get the same feeling now that I see all of these lead indicators that we really should be expressing caution. and people carrying on as if this is still a big bull market. The problem is that a lot of the factors that contribute to the beginning of a new secular bear are starting to flash, and that we will absolutely need to see a flood of new liquidity in order to really reignite bullish interest. So now let's look at the energy sector. So oil prices basically didn't really go anywhere between 2014 and 2020, but they did go down. Then between 2020 and 2022, we saw this phenomenally large jump where the price went from 20 to 140 in the space of 2 years. And now oil prices are holding here around the $80 level. So if we're in a still in a secular bull market, oil prices will not bounce from here. But the most important thing is that the secular bull markets we've had or we've had over the last decade has been about technology, low interest rates, and lower energy costs. And if oil prices steady from here, and there's the possibility that they can, particularly in the aftermath of a recession, whereas it's perhaps less likely before, then if we're looking at higher commodity prices, higher energy prices, higher interest rates, well, then we're not going to have a technology-led bull market. So then it really is an enormous question. How well do oil prices hold this $80 area? How well are copper prices going to hold around their current area? And how low will interest rates come when central banks actually have to respond to deflationary forces? Now, copper prices are still marching higher, and there's good reason for that, because regardless of everything else that's happening in Europe, carbon credit prices are still marching higher. And they were down ever so slightly in here today, but still testing that upper side of the more than year-long range. And it is government policy to have them go higher from here. That is forcing European consumers to produce less carbon. In doing so, it's raising costs. So, copper is integral to every single one of the renewable energy technologies, whether it is in solar or wind, and most particularly for the transmission cables from the remote locations where renewable energy is located to where it is in fact used. So, that is a very significant bullish factor for copper. Now, obviously, there is the potential that we're going to have a recession and that demand for metals will fall during that recession. But subsequently, with the impetus for the green movement, there is obviously the potential that demand will recover for renewable energy metals faster. This is also especially true for lithium. So lithium prices had surged higher in 2022. Now they're coming back down. I was chatting with a CEO of a company that is looking to build a lithium processing facility in the UK. And what they need to create green lithium, so no carbon emissions from the production facility, is for the lithium price to hold above the 20 to 25,000 area here. And well, it's in renminbi, so it's basically 250 thousand renminbi. If lithium holds that, then that those kinds of new company that are processing with very green credentials will survive. In the event that the price comes back below 20, then we could see a really significant shakeout in the new companies trying to develop business models and probably not paying a great deal of attention to the interest rate environment. So this is also a very important question. How many of the renewable energy companies are going to be viable in a higher interest rate environment? I can't help but look at the fact that a lot of the kinds of technology we've relied on for, and particularly those that started in the 1970s, they were very capital intensive to build, but they ensured that energy was affordable. And that was, I think, uranium, and a lot of the nuclear power plants were built in the late 60s and 1970s and into the 1980s. So that was a high interest rate environment, but then it was a clear focus on base load. And we're still using those today. And there was a big focus on diesel engines. And obviously, we've had the diesel cheating scandal, and nobody wants to own a diesel anymore. But there's no getting around the fact that diesel engines will keep going and going well into the 300,000 and 400,000 mile ranges, and then they are more fuel efficient as well. And that's obviously then very attractive in a high interest rate environment. And then we've had this explosion in interest in renewable energy in a time when technology has been fashionable and when interest rates have been low, because you certainly rely on cheap inputs in terms of commodities. You need cheap funding to go off and build these new projects. Their efficiency is less because they only work when the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. And then in order for them to reach scale and to actually make a dent in the energy mix, well, then you need additional technologies. So one is one that's sort of interesting is Fluence. So what they basically do is they have lithium batteries, and they're selling them to utilities. The big challenge for scaling up of wind and solar is that they tend to create surges, because there's lots of new energy comes onto the market very quickly. And then there's a limitation on how much energy can then come into the market because of that threat. So what Fluence does is it sells a battery solution, and then it levels out the surges and allows for greater growth of wind and solar in the energy mix. But of course, it comes at an additional cost. And then one has to also upkeep the lithium-ion batteries. So the share is also easing back here. Having got up to test the $25 area, it has pulled back to 20 and the upper side of the base formation. So if it's going to bounce, then it will really need to get about it. But this was the offshoot of a joint venture between Siemens and AES Corp. So there's certainly been a lot of money poured into the renewable energy sector already. But of course, what that also means is that and it is worth reminding ourselves that big bull markets make big promises, and then they follow through on those promises. So it is likely that we will have a renewable energy revolution, and we're going to need it. There will be a demand for lots more energy, and there will be demand for more copper. And there's not a great deal of enthusiasm to go out and build new copper mines. So Southern Copper, for example, is now right in the region of its all-time peak and pausing here. And it's a little overbought in the short term. So it's not at all unusual to see some pause and consolidation here. I'm certainly not ruling out the potential that we could have quite a bit of volatility when we do get the comeuppance from rising interest rates so quickly. But I think that will offer a buying opportunity. Then we also know that we're going to have several billion people coming into the most productive periods of their lives over the next decade. And the obvious question is, how much further will the dollar rally go? It has unwound its overextension relative to the 200-day moving average. It was in positive territory today, but if it isn't able to push up through that level, then that would also suggest that there will be interest in emerging markets, and gold will be able to hold the region of its 200-day moving average. And I think there's a fighting chance that it can do that. Then, because of the increasing geopolitical tensions with China, and we saw today that a very senior Chinese banker has disappeared and is helping authorities with their investigations. Well, that took some of the wind out of the Hang Seng, and it's rolling over and coming back into the region of the 200-day moving average. But the property sector in Hong Kong has broken down through the 200-day moving average. So we had a lot of enthusiasm about the Chinese market in the aftermath of the end of COVID zero. And I think that rebound is now over. And we're going to have to see a higher reaction low in order to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment beyond this short-term rebound that we've seen. But geopolitical tensions with China leaves a really significant window open for countries like India. Now, the Nifty index is still hovering here around the 200-day moving average. And India is a market that is best bought following reversions to the 1,000-day moving average. So I don't think we can rule out the possibility that we're going to have a fair share of volatility in India because it's a volatile market. And then the Mexican market is certainly benefiting from reshoring. It doesn't necessarily mean that reshoring means that those companies are going to come back to their original destination. Perhaps friendshoring is the more correct term. And Mexico is certainly benefiting, and the ETF has pushed up and out of this base formation that's been forming now for 7 years. And if we do see Brazil doing better, it'll be because of commodity prices. And the Brazil ETF is steadying in the region of the lower side of its range. I think what most people are paying attention to in Brazil is the outlook for interest rates and the standard of governance from the Lula administration. If we see that it's improving, then I think investors will be more than happy to plow money back into Brazil, and particularly if they start cutting interest rates as deflationary forces start to manifest. But then we can also think about Israel, where the I knew I haven't. Let me put up. I do apologize. I'm putting up the Israeli index. So they're threatening to curtail the independence of the judiciary. And that's obviously a central tenet of what we regard in terms of the standards of governance. And the others are individual shareholder rights and the freedom of the press. So the Tel Aviv index is back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average in local currency terms. Now, the Shekel was among the strongest currencies in the world last year. But even then, it's also back in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So if the Israeli market is going to find support, then it's going to be around here. If it fails and drops back through the 1,000-day moving average, we would have to conclude that this bull market has ended. And what I find especially interesting is the contrast, where you have countries like Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi trying to embrace better governance. And because you've got just disorganization and fractured politics in Israel, there's the threat of deteriorating standards of governance. So what it really does help to highlight is that it's not a static way of thinking, that there are clear developments that are going on internationally that will shape the way of thinking and how assets perform over time, and that there's really no country is immune from that. So that of course also means that there are lots of countries now where there are questions about governance, and there has been an acute reluctance to think about the future, or most particularly about how to pay for the future. Whereas there's been a clear trend to make big promises and not then to follow up with a clear way to actually deliver upon those promises. And that is a factor of low interest rates, because when there's money for everything, then you can make whatever promises you want. It's when interest rates rise that those questions about funding really start to come back to the fore. Now, let's just look at that bond yield from a really long-term perspective, because the consistency of the downtrend has been broken. So then one would have to conclude that in order for this downtrend to stay broken, then whenever yields do start to come back down, then they should hold the 2% level. And if that is indeed the case, then what we are looking at is the potential that asset prices are going to deflate over time, and the extraordinary values that have been achieved by commercial property in particular are going to be unwound, and that the exceptionally high values attached to companies that do not have the cash flows to justify them will also be unwound. Now, that is an argument for a secular bear market, where you have a generational long period of rising dividend yields and falling valuations. Well, that's what we had from 2000 all the way through until about 2013. So it's not like we can't have these moves, but I think in order to really conclude that that is where we are, then we will need to see a higher low in these government bond yields. That would mean that inflationary pressures are not vanquished, and that they come down somewhat, but that they do not go all the way back down, and we do not move back into a new deflationary environment. And if that is indeed the case, well, then we will start to see that income-producing assets will do better, that emerging markets will do better because they'll have a higher growth rate. And then gold should also do better in an environment where people are worried about inflation and want to have a real asset. And property generally does well in that environment. At least it holds its value in inflationary terms. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the exceptionally high prices that we see in several locations will be sustained indefinitely. So I think we're at a very critical juncture in markets generally, that there is the very significant potential that we are looking at regime change, and that interest rates would have to come down and stay down indefinitely in order to revitalize the trends that sustained bull markets over the last decade. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.